Hello and welcome back to the Slightly Fox podcast. We are heading north today with a guest who's been called the best nature writer working in Britain today. That's Jim Crumley. Before we meet him, Slightly Fox editor Gail Perkis is already in a wild and beautiful spot. Hi, Gail.
Yes, we're busy hunkering down for winter here. Huge numbers of leaves coming off the trees, wood piles being stocked up. It's rather a nice feeling, actually.
Yeah, Dartmoor seems quite an appealing place in the winter in some ways. My name is Philippa Lamb. I'm in rather less wild Cambridge. Gail's fellow editor, Hazelwood, joins us from civilised Highbury in North London.
Yes, I don't know about civilised at the moment, but it actually feels as if winter is closing in here. I'm looking forward to hearing about Scotland from Jim.
Now, I'm delighted to say we've got another fox with us today, a Stephanie Allen. Lovely to hear your voice again, Steph. How are you?
Hello. Very well, thank you. Enjoying a bit of sunshine on the Hampshire-Sussex border.
I'm betting you've got your hands full right now with Christmas coming up. It's your busiest time, isn't it?
It is, and we've got some wonderful books for Christmas. I think our standout bestseller, or what we hope will be our bestseller, is The Englishman's Commonplace book, put together by Roger Hudson. And we've done a little virtual launch for that. Anna and Hattie went along and took some photographs of Roger with Johnny DeFalb raising a glass at John Sandoz in Chelsea. And the photographs are on our website, along with the chance to purchase the book, signed copies and unsigned copies.
Oh, so presumably people need to jump in for the signed ones.
Absolutely, yes.
I think that you all foxes have been chatting about this idea of talking about literary destinations that we might all explore in perhaps more liberated times, or indeed have a look at on the web in the meantime. Which one have you picked to start us off with this?
I've chosen the Art Workers Guild because November is the time when we usually have our Readers' Day. It's an annual one-day literary festival that we started 10 years ago.
Yeah, we've covered it on the podcast, haven't we?
Yes. And this year we were going to have Michael Palin as our key speaker.
Oh, yes.
Among an array of other varied speakers. It's a lovely place, very individual building, which is what drew us to it. Because when we first looked at a venue, we were looking for somewhere that fitted the Slightly Fox ethos. So somewhere rather quirky, independent, and we found 6 Queen Square in London, a beautiful Georgian house that was established in 1884 by a group of young architects who were inspired by the arts and crafts movement.
It has this wonderful lecture hall, doesn't it?
It does. It has a large, airy lecture hall with a glass dome. There are pictures of the past masters all the way around the lecture hall. Queen Square itself is in the heart of Bloomsbury, and it just seemed to be an ideal setting for us.
It was originally, of course, on the edge of London, which now we would think of it as central London, and it was built so that it could look out on hilly Hampstead, which is an amazing thing to imagine now, isn't it? Because it's such an urban place.
Yeah, open fields. And it was a grand residential terrace with large 4 or 5 storey houses. Slowly, they were bought up by institutions, largely medical, unusual in that area, which was very sort of printing and creative. They have a number of neurological institutes there. They've got Great Ormond Street just round the corner. And in the very edges, there are a few literary establishments. So Faber and Faber was there, 2 doors down from the Art Workers Guild.
Where are they?
And on Lamb's Conduit Street, you've got Persephone Books and you've got Dickens House very close by.
Is it possible to actually go and see the Art Workers Guild under normal circumstances?
It's members only, and they have about 400 members, architects, artists, craftspeople. But they do, in normal times, they run exhibitions. In October, they hosted a series of lectures linked in with London Craft Week, because the aim at the Art Workers Guild was for it not to be a club, but a sort of meeting place of creative ideas, and the founders wanted to encourage creativity in everyday life, and I think that's what the Art Workers Guild still tries to do today.
They have an amazing array, don't they? I think they're called brothers, aren't they? Although obviously they include women. You know, Kenneth Clark, the painters Burne Jones and Alma Tadema. Ardazzoni was a member, wasn't he? And Voysey,
yes.
And Lutyens.
Yes.
Arthur Rackham. Every time we have a Reader's Day there, I actually sit and look at the list of names on the boards beneath the paintings. And every time I spot a new name that I hadn't realised he or she was connected to the guild.
There's a frieze round the top of the lecture hall where they have all the names of the masters. And they ran out of space in the year 2000, so that now carries on into the master's room. There are paintings, little bits of craft work everywhere. It's a really beautiful place.
There's a website, isn't there, Steph, with images?
There is, yes. And there is actually a guided tour of the building on their website, which you could take.
Hazel, that's not that far from Highbury, is it? You're in a bit of London. And Bloomsbury, well, it must be the most literary area of London, isn't it?
Yes, well, the whole area sort of round the British Museum, in those squares, it's of course particularly, I think, associated with the Bloomsbury Group.
Yeah.
And as I think Dorothy Parker famously said, they lived in squares, painted in circles and loved in triangles.
And this was Gordon Square, wasn't it, where they were?
Yes, well, that's where the Wolfe sisters and their group started. And it was the sort of nest of modernism, which was aiming to kind of blow away all the constraints and hypocrisies of the Victorians. And they started after their parents died. The sisters and their brother Toby moved to 46 Gordon Square. And they began to have meetings of something called the Friday Club. People like Lytton Strachey and E.M. Forster, Maynard Keynes, and they would meet to air their views in a very liberal and free way. Then, of course, Virginia married Leonard Wolfe, and they moved down to Richmond during the First World War, and they'd founded the Hogarth Press, and they moved back to Tavistock Square, and indeed now there is a bust of Virginia in Tavistock Square done by the sculptor Stephen Tomlin, who is also a friend. And it's there that really the sort of high days of the press, I suppose. And it's where Virginia wrote most of her best-known novels, Mrs. Dalloway and The Waves and The Lighthouse and Orlando. Lytton Strachey was at work on Eminent Victorians. And
yeah, seminal book.
Yes, it was all going on. And we did ourselves reissue a charming book by Richard Kennedy called A Boy at the Hogarth Press. It's faux naive. It was written much later, but about what went on there and Leonard's desperate struggles for economy. So the whole place is very, very redolent of that era. It still has that feeling about it, one of the few areas of London, I think, that does.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, for readers, for people interested in reading, it is the perfect place just to do a street walk, isn't it? Because it's awash with literary blue plaques. Thanks for that, Steph. Am I right in thinking we heard your dogs in the background there?
You might have done, yes. I did tell them to be quiet, but they never listened to me.
They're springers, aren't they?
Well, sadly, we lost our two springers over lockdown.
Oh.
We now have a Bedlington and a Bichon Frise cross King Charles, who is the very noisy one. She's called Maggie and she doesn't listen to anyone.
She's also known as Princess Margaret, isn't she, Steph?
Yes.
I need to know why. Why is she known as Princess Margaret?
Because she's got a sense of entitlement, I think.
Like all the Slightly Fox dogs. Thanks, Steph. On to this month's literary discussion now. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jim Crumley to the podcast. Hello, Jim. Where are you?
Hello. I'm in Stirling, right in the middle of the country, in Scotland, in my house, which is right on the edge of Stirling, more or less on the field of Bannockburn.
Oh, ah. Goodness.
Yeah. Keep looking around to see if there's a bit of a broken battle axe or something lying, but so far we haven't found one. And the great virtue of it for me is that it's sort of on the cusp between Highland and Lowland. So there's an arc of mountains from sort of Ben Lomond in the west round to Ben Vorlich, and Ben Leddy is right in the middle. And from here, it's a kind of pyramid shape. So it's a very prominent landmark in my everyday life.
So you're a writer's territory, if I can put it in those terms. It's the Trossachs National Park, isn't it, really? Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of my basic field work is done in the area. It's the sort of eastern part of the Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park. And I tend to stay as far away from Loch Lomond as I can because it's
touristy, yeah.
But from there north into the mountains, there's a whole series of lochs and quite well wooded. And that's the kind of territory that I inhabit on a more or less daily basis. One of the good things I've always found about having what I think of as a writer's territory is that with the way that nature works in that particular landscape, the rhythms that it moves to, if something new happens, you tend to find out about it quite quickly. And the other great virtue of it is that the knowledge that you gather, it's been more than 30 years now, is actually transferable. You can go all kinds of places in the Northern Hemisphere and find that the basic principles of the way that nature works transfer. Having that territory to fall back on is an absolutely priceless thing for me.
And you're blessed with a great diversity of wildlife there, aren't you?
Yes.
Tell us about the sort of animals you encounter in your explorations, Jim.
From time to time, when I'm doing talks and things, I get questions about how come I see so much. There's an element of suspicion in the way the question is framed sometimes. Right. It's all to do with the amount of time that you spend there. I mean, for every wonderful encounter, there will be hundreds of hours in which nothing at all happens, and you don't write about that.
Indeed.
I mean, everything from the more obvious things like foxes to pine martens to very occasionally wildcat. Lots of deer, and one of my great enthusiasms is I champion the cause of the reintroduction of wolves. That would be a game changer as far as, you know, nature is concerned. And I've done a lot of work with golden eagles. There's an eyrie an hour's drive from here that I've watched off and on over about 40 years now. And again, it's that thing of repeating the same set of landscape circumstances and watching how things change over the years. And if you spend a lot of time focused on one species like that, you don't just find out about golden eagles, you find out about everything that it shares the landscape with, the creatures that it interacts with and the ones that it avoids.
Recently, you've worked on a wonderful seasonal quartet. And I think you've just published the last one this summer, didn't you? It's The Nature of Summer.
Yes.
Tell us about the quartet, Jim.
I wanted to write a book about autumn. Quite a few years ago now, I was driving back down from Skye. It was in the autumn and I'd had a beautiful few days up there. About halfway down the road, turned a corner, there was a stand of aspens on the roadside. And aspens, when they do their autumn thing, they're better than anything else, really. And they were backlit by the sun.
Uh-huh.
Sunlight was bouncing off the loch and bouncing back up into the trees. So the effect of the light on it was quite astonishing. And crucially, I had a Roy Orbison CD on in the car. The whole series of books is Roy Orbison's fault. He was singing a song called It's Over, and the first line is golden days before the end, whisper secrets to the wind. And that hit me as I was driving around this corner and I saw the aspens. So at the next opportunity, I stopped the car, I got a notebook out of the glove box, I wrote down golden days before the end, a book about autumn. And that's where the whole thing started. Every now and again, I would find this notebook and I would come across this reference, and I thought, I must do something about that sometime.
What prompted you to actually get to it and start writing?
I had finished doing a book about beavers for Sarah Laband, who's my publisher. And again, it was autumn, and I thought, this is a good time to start writing the autumn book. Sarah Hunt, who runs Sarah Laband, was very enthusiastic about the first draft that I showed her, but didn't like the title because she thought there might be problems with international copyright lawyers in Nashville. And
okay.
And basically, she said, have you any idea how much it would cost us if we did get permission?
So you had to think again.
And I came up with The Nature of Autumn. And then there was an email from Sarah saying, yeah, and that leaves the way open for The Nature of Winter, The Nature of Spring and The Nature of Summer.
See, that made me laugh, Gail, you as a publisher, leveraging the idea of one great book. But yes, but we can have four.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Publishers are always keen to exploit every opportunity.
You must have had a lot of fun writing those, Jim.
It's been really good, yeah. I was kind of ambivalent right at the start because, I say, the idea had been very much, autumn's my favourite time of the year. I was kind of locked into that, but not into the idea of what I know is now a tetralogy. I didn't know the word.
Explain it for us.
It's a trilogy plus one, that's all.
I've got to say, that's a new one on me. When we chatted a few months ago, you mentioned a writer, Scottish naturalist, that I'd never heard of, Seton Gordon.
Oh.
Tell us about him, because I think you said to me he was a huge influence on you.
Gosh, where to start? I can't actually remember now when I first came across his writing. He was an astonishing individual. Seton Gordon came out of the Victorian era, and he was really the first one who was determined to look at nature through the barrel of a telescope rather than along the barrel of a shotgun. And he very, very early on became an enthusiast and slowly an expert on golden eagles. But he had quite a privileged background, grew up in Aberdeenshire. His two best books are The Cairngorm Hills of Scotland and The Charm of Skye. The Cairngorm book is very much about a man walking in the mountains, interacting with wildlife. Actually, you get very, very little of Seton Gordon himself in his books. It's a thing that I kind of like about the book. A great deal of 21st century nature writing is very strongly centred on the writer.
Yeah, personality driven.
Him or herself. Seton Gordon is never that. He has an extraordinary gift that in the midst of sustained passages of pure nature writing, he will suddenly stop, drop a little passage of a few lines into the text that make you stop in your tracks. You suddenly have an inkling of what this man is like. There's one in the Cairngorms where he's been talking about the view from around 4,000 feet, where the view is suddenly expanding as clouds lift. And he wrote this: "One was reluctant to leave the high tops on an evening such as this. In the immense silences of these wild corries and dark rocks, the spirit of the high and lonely places revealed herself, so that one felt the serene and benign influence that has, from time to time, caused men to leave the society of their fellows and live on some remote surf-drenched isle, as St. Cuthbert did on Farne. There to steep themselves in those spiritual influences that are hard to receive in the crowded hours of human life." And that's just dropped into the narrative. And the first time I read that, it just absolutely stopped me dead. When I eventually did write a book about the Cairngorms, I stole the title from him, A High and Lonely Place.
Yeah, and if you've ever been in that landscape with your boots on, you know how he felt, why he felt like that, don't you? Because it is an astonishing place.
Yeah. It's one of the most remarkable places I've been. Once you get up onto the plateau, there is really nothing like it, because there are not really any jaw-dropping views. The summits are sort of undulations rather than defining peaks. And quite often, if you're out in the middle of the plateau, the only view really is the sky. Not that many places where you can do that. The other thing about Stephen Gordon was that when he moved west, the voice of his writing sort of tilted. He learned Gaelic, and he would write a passage in which the sentence construction was as if you were literally translating the Gaelic. Ah. And it has an extraordinary effect. And again, it was one of those things, when I first read it, I was just beginning to become aware of the possibilities that exist to strive for literature within nature writing.
He wrote dozens of books, didn't he? He was writing right up until the 70s, and he was in his 90s then at that time. Are they still available? Are any of them in print?
Yes, some of them have been reprinted quite recently. One of his very early books, which he wrote in 1921, called Amid Snowy Wastes, and it's about an Oxford University trip he went on to Spitsbergen. And throughout his writing life, he would draw comparisons between Spitsbergen at more or less sea level and the Cairngorms Plateau, articulating why the Cairngorms are so important as a landscape, because they are essentially what's left of a kind of Arctic alpine ecosystem in this country. But yeah, his range was amazing. He wrote three books about golden eagles, and in the last one, which I think he wrote in the 1950s, he says something like, "It's now some time since I first photographed a golden eagle on the Eyrie, brackets, April 1904.
Gosh, quite a while.
Yeah, and you suddenly think of the reach of this man, yeah, to the extent that he's still regarded to this day as one of the great voices.
Yeah, I mean, the same tradition, Jim. I know the American nature writers have been a big influence on you too.
Yes, the range of American nature writing is astonishing. I'm a big fan. I picked up a book, I guess it must have been about 20, 21, something like that, that had a picture on the cover of wild geese flying over this extraordinary looking landscape, and it turned out to be a Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. I now regard that as just the single greatest work of nature writing, full stop. And that was my introduction to American nature writing. I suppose it spoiled me, because it's like getting the very best one first.
Yes.
But since then, I've explored a great deal of American nature writing. And another one that made a huge impact very early on was Barry Lopez, a book called Arctic Dreams. Again, it's one of these little passages that hit me between the eyes the first time I read it. "Whatever evaluation we finally make of a stretch of land, no matter how profound or accurate, we will find it inadequate. The land retains an identity of its own, still deeper and more subtle than we can know. Our obligation toward it then becomes simple, to approach with an uncalculating mind, with an attitude of regard. To try to sense the range and variety of its expression, its weather and colour and animals. To intend from the beginning to preserve some of the mystery within it as a kind of wisdom to be experienced, not questioned. And to be alert for its openings, for that moment when something sacred reveals itself within the mundane, and you know the land knows you are there."
There's a long tradition, isn't there, Jim, of Scottish nature writers, American nature writers, not just reading, but influencing each other. And you had a great loop back. I think it took us all the way back to Burns.
Oh, yes. I'm working just now on a book set in the Lake District, a new departure for me. And I had more or less determined that the two people who weren't going to be mentioned were Wordsworth and Wainwright. And of course, it's not possible.
Not really.
But it is very much a book about nature within a particular corner of the Lake District. And I had started to look at Wordsworth's attitude towards landscape and what led to it. I had discovered that Emerson had met Wordsworth a couple of times and they had had fascinating conversations, and Emerson took the kind of romantic tradition back to America with him. I also discovered at more or less the same time that one of the singular influences on Wordsworth himself had been Robert Burns. And Burns always intrigued me. His poem To a Mouse has this verse in it in which he apologises to nature, basically for mankind screwing up the planet. He uses the phrase nature's social union. And I've always wondered, where on earth did he get the idea of nature's social union from? And there is nothing in Burns's life that suggests that it came from an influential figure before him. It's like he had come up with this idea of nature's social union and that mankind was a part of that. So I then started to follow this line that Burns had an effect on Wordsworth. Wordsworth galvanised Emerson, who then in turn galvanised Thoreau, Walt Whitman, and both of these writers galvanised John Muir, who founded the national park system in America. And Muir, in turn, enthused a young forestry student called Aldo Leopold, who was the guy who wrote his Sand County Almanac, which brings it into the 20th century. So I find myself struggling to comprehend how interlinked this 200-300 years of writing has washed up on my doorstep almost.
It's a fantastic literary daisy chain. You're going to write about it at length?
Yes.
We'll look forward to that, I think. It's the American writers, I think, who also set you on the path to your great passion for species reintroduction. You mentioned this earlier, grey wolf. You would like to see the grey wolf back in Scotland, I understand. Mm.
If you explore, in particular, the story of the reintroduction in Yellowstone, which has been the most studied group of wolves ever and the most written about, you find the impact is so transformative that it almost single-handedly creates conditions in which, with the wolves in place, everything in nature starts to make sense. And without them, very little actually makes sense, because the top predator, the one that makes the rules in a northern hemisphere landscape, is missing. And we, mankind, humankind, tries to do the job of top predator, and demonstrably we are seriously crap at the job. I wrote a book a few years ago called The Last Wolf. I was in a lot of ways fired up by the Yellowstone experience. The thing that I wanted to do with The Last Wolf was, first of all, to rewrite the history of the wolf in Scotland, because what there is, which is pretty scant, had been written by the Victorians, and it's absolutely awful.
So you think they've been misrepresented in literature?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Uh-huh. You cannot read a book about wolves written in Britain up to the 19th century, say, without it. The kind of language it uses is that the country was infested by the rabid droves. You get that all the time. They're not just areas with wolves in them. They're areas that are infested by wolves. And they're always rabid. It's very interesting. I started to explore the Last Wolf stories, and there are quite a few of them around, and everywhere from Sutherland to Devon. I started to find in the Last Wolf stories, there were common factors. The wolf that had to be killed, and it was always killed by a big guy, you know, a kind of superhero, always happened in winter, usually near Christmas. It involved a woman on her own or with young children crossing a snowy landscape. And then the tragedy happens. The wolves attack the woman, and then the hero comes a little bit too late and finds the wolf and kills it, quite often with his bare hands. And these details are just repeated again and again and again. And there's a story in Scotland of the Findhorn River, which is supposed to be that of the Last Wolf. And I concentrated on that one and slowly dismantled it. And I discovered that it was written down about 60, 70 years after the event by a guy who was an obsessive disciple of Walter Scott. And what he was trying to do was to write a Walter Scott type account of this killing of the last wolf. And he put it into direct speech. And the guy who kills the wolf, who is 6'7", but he does it with his bare hands in a dirk, he puts this story into the direct speech of this guy. But these words have actually gone into the literary of the landscape, and they've been reproduced again and again by people who should quite honestly know better as a verifiable account.
As reported speech from the time.
The killing of the last wolf.
Right.
And it's fiction from beginning to end. And it took me half an hour in a library in Inverness to find how this book was written. So if the history needs rewritten, you also need something to say, look, this is what a wolf is, this is what it does, this is how it behaves. And then the third part of the book was to articulate the case for the reintroduction.
But as you say, Jim, I mean, wolves are vilified in literature, fairy tales, Red Riding Hood, not just in the UK, but across Europe and beyond. Why do you think that is? Is it just because they are the apex predator? It's the big bad wolf?
I don't think so. I think the roots of it are in the spread west of Christianity. Christ was the good shepherd. The wolf was a problem for shepherds. The people are the flock, and therefore the wolf is therefore the agent of the devil.
It's a metaphor.
Absolutely. And that has spread right through. And you find the same stories again and again. You find them in Russia, you find them in Eastern Europe, you find them in the Mediterranean, you find them here, Ireland. And then we effortlessly exported them to the New World. I mean, in the States now, there are last wolf stories in every different American state. European settlers in America made sure that the relationship between the Native Americans and wolves was transformed from being a thing of coexistence. If you go into a lot of the literature of Native Americans, you find the idea of the wolf and a teacher are absolutely interchangeable.
That's interesting.
But it's the capacity of the wolf to affect every other species in the food chain. In America, from grizzly bears right down to pinewood ants and the things that pinewood ants eat, it's right through the whole thing. They have had huge impact, very clearly demonstrated in America, in the Yellowstone experience of changing the very nature of the land itself, changing the colour of the land because of their capacity to inhibit overgrazing. One of the first animals that followed wolves into Yellowstone were beavers. So beavers came because of the opportunities that the wolves were creating by regeneration of woodland. So beavers bring the capacity to reintroduce and restore and expand wetland. And the two working together sparked off this huge chain reaction. I mean, if we dared to do it in this country, the impact would be astounding.
It's a fascinating analysis. I hesitate to ask you about an entirely different species, but I know you also have thoughts about swans in literature, don't you?
Yeah, there are very few species that mankind is willing to change places with or interact with to the extent that we have done with swans. And again, it's one of these things which is right across the world. And it's the idea that the soul is transported to the hereafter on the wings of swans. It's something which is right through all the Northern Hemisphere countries. And there's even a black swan version of it among Aboriginal Australians. There's a story about how the white swan became black. And it's also a very nice metaphor about the relationship between settlers in Australia and the Aborigines. But I got fascinated with that. By that time, I had become intrigued with the whole species of swans and everything from the mute swan that we all know and love. I studied a nest site on Loch Lubnig, 20-odd miles from here. I studied it for 30 years. There was a pair of swans there that just broke all the rules all the time. And that really started to intrigue me about the species. I became particularly intrigued by pooper swans, which come to us from Iceland and Scandinavia. And then I was very lucky to spend some time in Alaska and saw my first ever pair of trumpeter swans. It's a swan with a 10-foot wingspan, which is quite a thing.
Wow.
And the aesthetics of watching swan in flight just, you know, taken hold of me in a way that really hasn't happened with any other species. And the great thing about swans is they're not difficult to watch. You know, you can watch their behaviour almost everywhere. But there's an awful lot more to them than the swan in the pond in the public park. And the great thing about this pair on Loch Lubnig was that it was almost as if nature's odds were stacked against them to the extent that they would lose their nest year after year to flooding. And yet they remained loyal to the nest site. And
that is that a good thing, Jim? Why are they so loyal to the spot if it's not working for them?
That's a thing that I've never been able to understand. One thing that I've learned for absolute certain about swans is that they don't think the way I do. There was one year on this particular nest site, they made 5 different attempts to nest. The swan nests are huge, serious pieces of civil engineering. So they made 5 nests. They finally got 3 eggs on their 5th nest, one of which hatched about August, hopelessly late in the season to have any chance of making it into adulthood. Mm-hmm. But I documented that entire nesting season. I've never come across anything like it.
I was wondering, Jim, what first started you writing at the very beginning?
Well, it was about all I could do at school. And at 16, I became a trainee newspaper journalist and worked in newspapers for 20-something years until I plucked up the courage to do what I really wanted to do. The very first page of The Nature of Autumn is about my very earliest memory, which is of geese flying over in my parents' house, Corporation Prefab, right on the edge of Dundee, the last street in town, basically. We were about a mile from the Tay Estuary. We were on the flight path of pink-footed geese. That particular flight of geese right at the beginning of autumn is absolutely the first intact memory that I have of anything.
And Jim, when we spoke a few weeks ago, you also mentioned a book which is your sort of touchstone for your writing, Neil Gunn's Highland River.
Yeah, I came across Neil Gunn's writing, I suppose, in my 20s. Highland River, I don't know another book anything like it. It doesn't really have a plot other than it's a kind of a quest to explore this river in Caithness, a kind of metaphor that runs right through the whole book. And it was this relationship between the boy, the river, the wildlife, and this profound sense of this, which really struck a chord with me. The principles of the relationship I could identify with very strongly. That was something that really, really made me start to think, you know, if I became an author of the kind of books that I might dare to think I could write sometime in the future.
And you write about things. You've got a regular column, haven't you, in the Scots magazine, Wild About
Yes.
Scotland. So if people are interested, while we're waiting for your next book, they can look out for your work in there.
Indeed.
Jim, I think we'll have to wrap it up then. Thank you so much. Will you stay with us and give us a book recommendation in a moment?
I'll do that. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Now, do not worry if you lost track of the many books that Jim mentioned there. They're all listed in the show notes attached to the episode. If you listen on the website, you can also find them there. That's foxedquarterly.com. Now, we will have book recommendations from everyone next, but first, a word about Slightly Foxed.
Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you.
Now, recommended reads, please, from everyone. I'm going to start with Hazel.
I was recently given a book called Featherhood by Charlie Gilmore, which is a slightly tricksy title, and I suppose it would be possible to sort of dismiss it, really, because it's got a celebrity overtone. Charlie Gilmore is the stepson of David Gilmore of Pink Floyd. He was slightly notorious for going off the rails and climbing the cenotaph during some important ceremony and ended up in jail. His mother is Polly Sampson, the novelist. It's a book, I suppose, about sort of nature versus nurture. It's partly a search to know about his own father, who was a man called Heathcote Williams. He was a poet, a sort of mystic. He wrote a quite famous poem called Whale Nation. But he had an affair with Charlie's mother and then just completely went off the rails and left them. And the book is partly about Charlie's search to try and understand this strange father of his and to make contact with him. But it's done in tandem with the story of how his girlfriend brought home a baby magpie, which they adopted and adopted them. And it's really about Charlie's sort of getting to know this bird, which more or less took them over, and at the same time trying to find his father, who strangely had also adopted jackdaw. I mean, his observation of this magpie is very amusing and touching. He's trying to come to terms with whether he can ever be a father himself, and eventually the magpie is released into the wild and appears to survive. He does make contact with his father very unsatisfactorily during his life. And I think it's quite a raw book, really, but very well observed. I would recommend it.
Jim?
A writer who I have discovered comparatively recently is Susan Fletcher. And the book that I'd like to recommend is called Silver Dark Sea. It's set in a Scottish island and centres around a man who is found on the beach, who has kind of come out of the sea. There is a local story about a fishman, and it's a kind of sort of akin to the Selkie stories. And she incredibly skillfully manoeuvres this notion of the fishman, a man with a fish tail, who comes out of the sea and is taken in by this tiny island community, and the impact that the man has, the different responses from different people in this very small island community. Is beautifully done in the way that it portrays the island landscape. And I had never read anything like this book. I discovered it about 3 years ago, and it's one I've already read 3 times. So that's as good a recommendation as you can get.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Steph?
The book I have chosen is A Month in Siena by Hisham Mattar. Similarly to Hazel, it's really prompted by a search for his father. Hisham wrote The Return, which was the story of his return to Libya to search for his father, who'd been arrested by Gaddafi and disappeared. That book actually won the Slightly Foxed Best First Biography Award, along with the Pulitzer Prize, which slightly overshadowed it.
Well, I don't know.
That was a fantastic book. And in that, Hisham wrote that at the age of 19, when his father disappeared, he would go to the National Gallery and spend hours in front of a single picture. And he would go back week after week, month after month. He would give a couple of months to one single picture. So engrossed was he by these pictures. And he was particularly interested in the Sienese school of painting. So it had been, Siena became a sort of mystical place for him, somewhere that he'd always wanted to visit. And 25 years later, he goes to Siena with his wife, who's with him for a fortnight, and she then comes back to the UK. And it is literally his thoughts on the pictures that he goes to see. There are the famous friezes there, the effect of good government and the effect of bad government. And he just writes wonderfully about these pictures, about his thoughts, about love, loss, grief. He really is a marvellous writer. It's quite a short book, just over 100 pages. I've read it this summer. I'm going to read it again because it is, like Jim was saying, this is the sort of book that you can go back to. It has so many wonderful lines in it, beautifully written, and I'd recommend it to anyone.
Really interesting choice. Thanks, Steph. Gail?
I'm going to recommend a book called The Hunting Party by Lucy Foley, and it's unashamedly a rip-roaring thriller. In fact, it's a reinvention of the country house mystery. And appropriately, it's set in Scotland in a remote hunting lodge. And it starts with a group of friends boarding the train at King's Cross, and they're going up to Scotland for New Year. They've all known each other for a very long time. They were all at Oxford together. And it starts with one of them narrating the story, and then as you progress, it switches to another character. And each time the narrator changes, you get insights into the other characters. They arrive at a tiny little station up in the wilds, and they're picked up by the two people who are running this lodge and who will the next day take them to shoot a deer. And gradually it becomes clear that there are all sorts of lies being told amongst the group, and there are all sorts of secrets. And it ends with a murder, but for a long time you don't actually know who's been killed. There are flashbacks or flash forwards to the body being discovered, and the tension builds. It's incredibly gripping, quite claustrophobic, and I couldn't put it down. I can't tell you much more about it because I don't want to give away the plot. But if you want a book to lose yourself in on a dark winter's evening and you like murder stories, this is the book for you.
It sounds like a real curl up on the sofa in front of the fire.
Absolutely.
Thank you, everyone. That is it for this month. Thanks again, Jim, for introducing us to your Scotland and making the case for the much maligned wolf. It's been a real treat to have you. Thank you.
Been a great pleasure. Thanks.
We'll be back on December 15th when we'll be joined by Alexandra Harris for a high-speed literary history of winter from Beowulf to Virginia Woolf. Do not miss it. It's ambitious, but I think it's going to be fun. Visit the Slightly Foxed website to subscribe to the quarterly magazine. You can browse through their books there. Christmas is coming. After all, foxquarterly.com is the web address. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do rate us on whichever app you use to listen. We would love it if you would write us a review there too, if you can spare the time. For now, though, thanks as always for listening and for joining us on this month's literary expedition off the beaten track.